It's 7 p.m. Thursday, and this is All About Wine. With All About Wine's resident wine expert, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida Estates Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida.
First, we were talking last week about Asian wineries and Asian grapes. We're going to finish up Australia today. That's what we're doing with the France. So we're continuing with France. Nice. Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly. Mike and I were talking about the possibilities of hooking up with different wineries in different states and finding out what's going on. Sounds like it might be a whole lot of fun.
Holyfield Vineyard and Winery in Basser, Kansas.
Organic Farm on the coast of Maine near Mount Desert Island.
Westport Rivers, Westport Mass.
Haverhill.com. The Napa Valley of the Midwest.
RainbornWines.com. In Santa Rosa.
Ten Spoon in Montana.
Alba Vineyards.
We're the largest estate vineyard in New Jersey.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery, New Jersey's top-rated winery for 2011.
India Vineyards on Route 93 is the main highway coming right up the center of New Hampshire out of Massachusetts.
Bebock Winery, we are actually the highest-rated red wines in New Mexico.
Well, Southwest Wine is actually located in Deming, New Mexico.
Well, La Viña is the oldest winery in New Mexico.
Castello di Borghese, the first winery established in Long Island.
Blackhead Lake Winery, and we're located at Cushu Park in Montana.
Famous Prairie Winery in Moscow, Idaho.
Brotherhood is America's oldest winery since 1839.
Ithaca, New York, College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
The website is freethegrapes.org.
All right, grab a phone and let's talk about wine tonight. Dial area code 646-727-3235. That's 646-727-3235. All right, let's start the show and let's talk about wine. Oh, they are enjoying it out here for sure tonight.
It's gorgeous.
Been great. Yeah, absolutely. And it's also gorgeous, I guess, in the area. They're looking at some rain Thursday, looks like, in Liberty, Missouri. That's what talking about tonight. Yeah.
Like it.
Yeah. Unless the Weather Channel is not accurate for that part of the country. But
they're usually pretty good. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So that's near Kansas City. Is that what I'm looking at?
Yeah, just northeast of Kansas City. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. For those of you just joining us, I kind of jumped the gun there, but we were talking about we're going to be talking to a winery in Liberty, Missouri. So that'll be cool. We're just covering the weather.
Yeah, and for that area, and for us, because it's gorgeous here. If you're listening to us on archives, then. Hey, we had a gorgeous day today, and it's supposed to continue. Wow, we're supposed to have some real nice weather for the next 5, 6, 7 days down here. So,
cold front's coming through tonight or sometime. It's going to drop us into the low 70s or upper 70s.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Get the coat and the gloves out. So,
I know. Yeah. I was digging through that today, getting my winter gear out.
Yes.
I heard cold front, and so I started to worry.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Covered the plants. So everything's covered.
Yeah, I got them all down. I harvested my pineapple this evening.
Oh, was that that's the single one that you had on the, where was that? That was.
Yeah, out on the porch.
My
pineapple, it's time for harvest, so I actually harvested it this evening and right before the show, and I will be trimming up, having myself a little bit of fresh pineapple. But you know, with the cold front coming in, I didn't want it to cause any damage. Right. And so I had to get out and harvest. Went out and harvested.
Pineapple harvest here in Florida.
Pineapple harvest, all right. Pumpkin, pineapple, it's that time of year.
Okay. Sounds good.
So I got a pineapple to trim up after the program here, after the show tonight.
Nice.
I
will get out of here and get our guest. Yeah.
We are going to Liberty, Missouri tonight. Actually, we were at Liberty a couple of weeks ago. What was it, 3 weeks ago when we visited a winery up there? And we are back there again. The reason we're back there again is because, actually, I'm from that area. I'm just, Liberty, I used to, one of my stomping grounds and all that. And I was back there visiting family and friends again 2 or 3 weeks ago. I had a big cousin reunion, actually, and up in Iowa. And we will be visiting an Iowa winery probably next week, so stay tuned for that. But tonight we're going to be visiting with Belvoir Winery and Liberty of our winery. Jesse is our is going to be our guest tonight. And Belvoir has a it's sort of ironic that it is right now we're visiting them because they have a lot of ghost, yes, ghost in their area, in their winery, downstairs and all that. And we hopefully Jesse can explain to us what that's all about. It's a beautiful winery. Their website, if you like to click on it and see while you're listening to us, www.belvoirwinery.com, belvoirwinery.com. You can take a look at it and see the events that they have coming up. They do have paranormal events and all sorts of things going on there. But we'll talk to Jesse and we'll see what he has to say about it and have him tell us all about it. And it looks like he's there waiting for us, so let's bring him onto the program. Hello, Jesse. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
How are you?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
Very well.
Good, good. Noticed I've been telling the people out there that not only is Belvoir Winery located in Liberty and you make wine, but you also have a big history of ghosts and goblins, paranormal activity in the winery there.
Yeah, we have a little bit of everything.
I think you're the first winery we visited that has ghosts.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of history at the property, so, you know, it's kind of one of the things where it builds upon it, for sure.
But tell us about Belvoir Winery.
We're a winery opened almost 2 years ago now. We'll be 2 years in January in Liberty, Missouri, which is a suburb of Kansas City. And we grow grapes on the property and produce wines. And then we also host a lot of events at our site. We have renovated. Our buildings are in the National Register of Historic Places. And we've renovated about 13,000 square foot of one of the buildings and turned it into an event location for things like weddings, anniversary, birthday, wedding showers, baby showers, you know, you name it, we do it.
You also have an ice cream shop on the premises, too.
We do.
Yeah, which is cool. Grapes there, what grapes you grow?
The grapes that we go on site are Norton, Chamberson, Vignole, and Golden Muscat. We do, Missouri is a little different. Some of the areas where we, a lot of the wineries, they'll purchase from local vineyards. We have a lot of vineyards in the area that grow just solely for agriculture purposes and then sell to the wineries. We're growing, the state's growing about 10 wineries a year right now. And so there's a demand that's not fully kept up with all the wineries popping up. Of course, a lot of them open without a full vineyard in place at the time, a mature vineyard. So it's definitely a growing industry, and so we have a little of both. We grow and purchase as well.
So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. You say you're growing. I noticed, what is there, 130 wineries in Missouri now?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, it's always changing, to be honest with you, but yeah, that 130 is about right. We used to be, obviously, before Prohibition, the number one wine producer in the nation. Then Prohibition hit, and a lot of the Missouri wineries switched over to production of things like mushrooms in their caves and things like that. And then when Prohibition was lifted, our market was slow to recover. We're still in top 10 in the nation as far as wine production, but of course, California kind of took the reins a little quicker than we did after Prohibition.
Yeah, and ran with it.
Yes, exactly. So,
well, it's interesting you say that, because I just a few weeks ago I was talking about the biggest wineries as far as production goes in the country, and all of them are from California except for one, and that is Stonehill there in Missouri. And so there is quite a bit being produced and grown in Missouri as far as grapes and wine. So,
yeah, I think we're right around number 9 last I checked, something like that. But yeah, before Prohibition, two of the three biggest wineries in the nation were in Missouri. So there's a lot of German roots. A lot of German immigrants came into places like Herman, Missouri, which I'm sure some have heard of. There's a big industry there where the German immigrants came over and they found that area, and it was a lot like the land they had left, you know, near where the Rhine is in Germany. And so that's the reason they settled there, and it turned out they made a pretty good decision because there's some very nice ground there for grapes for sure. But, as you know, as time went along, if you look at the map of Missouri as far as where the wineries are, there's a lot of wineries located along the Missouri and Mississippi River, obviously, where you get some good hilly conditions, some fertile conditions where, you know, the river has moved in a lot of good nutrients and allows for some pretty good grape growing.
Yeah, and it's also because of the, well, we can go all the way back to the Ice Age, how it's pushed the soil down and all that. And there's some great soil just about everywhere in the state. That's something that you can see in production of not just grapes, but corn and everything else in the northern part of the state.
Yep, absolutely.
I'm familiar with your vineyard there. I stopped by and met you and talked to you for a while there. But for the listeners, what type of soil do you have there for your grapes?
Well, strangely enough, our county is called Clay County, and it's called that for a reason. It is mainly a clay soil. Now, we are very fortunate on our property specifically. We have some underground springs. There was actually a hotel that was on the site even before the current buildings, and they had a springs hotel there where people come and bathe in the healing springs and that kind of stuff. But what the springs provide is a good soil content, a good moist soil content in certain areas of our property that some of the areas, other areas don't have. Without that, obviously, there are certain areas where on the property where it's just simply not growable. We'll have to, you know, redo the soil just to make it where we can grow grapes. But the areas where the springs are actually pretty fertile, it's a clay-based soil, but there is some black dirt areas in the areas where the springs are that it's not too bad at all.
Yeah, I know. You say clay. I grew up in North Kansas City there, just not too far from you. And I'll tell you, you dig down 6 inches and you're getting into just a lot of clay, and that's it's just amazing that you can grow grapes there and not have more of a problem than you do. So I can understand.
I was going to say too, there are in some areas of the property that we've tried to plant 3 or 4 times, and it's just a no dice thing. It's one of those things where we'll have to, you know, take a dozer to it and tear down into it and then rebuild the soil in some of those areas because the erosion has taken away some of the soil. And we have a lake at the base of the property that, you know, over time a lot of that fertile ground has come off the clay and is down in the lake now. So hopefully we can reclaim some of that at some point as well.
Yeah, I hope so. Have to water a lot because of the clay actually would retain a lot of the moisture to the top. So do you have to water a lot, or is it pretty much take care of itself through the year?
It does take care of itself for the most part. Even, you know, we had obviously some heavy drought conditions this year. And even with those kind of conditions, we still were pretty good. And obviously the underground springs around our vines help quite a bit. It doesn't give it obviously a wet factor by any means, but it gives that slight moisture that allows it to survive those heavy drought conditions, whereas if we didn't have that underground moisture, it would have been a much different situation that would have definitely required some irrigation.
The trellising system, what do you hand pick everything, or do you machine pick? What do you use on you?
Yeah, we just have we hand pick everything. We usually, around the time of harvest, we'll put on our Facebook site, you know, we'll let people know that we're going to be harvesting, and it's a nice deal for our regulars that are out there. They, you know, bring out their kids and come out, and we give them the tools that they need, show them how they can pick, and go ahead and have them. Honestly, at least half of the picking is done by people that aren't employed by the property. They just come out, and it's a neat experience because, honestly, even though the wine industry is growing and doing well at the same time, there's a whole lot of people in our area who haven't really got to experience a winery. You know, they haven't traveled out to California and they haven't necessarily gone to some of the wineries in the area. So it's a nice opportunity for them to come out and do those kind of things. And the trellis is just a basic trellis, upper and lower lines. It's honestly nothing fancy, but it's it gets the job done, as far, especially like our Nortons and our Muscat. They do really well with a simple trellis system.
Oh, great. You know, that you mentioned people coming out, though. That's a great thing, because I think a lot of wineries do that, and it gets people involved with it, and it's such a great thing. I have a lot of people come into the winery down here and tell me, oh, yeah, I used to help pick grapes up at this winery or that winery. So it's something that people really enjoy, and it's something they hang on to the memories of it when they do it. So it's great that you're doing that there. While we're still out in the vineyard talking about that, your winter highs and lows, your summer highs and lows, and when do you get bud break and when do you harvest? What?
I'll do the last part first. Bud break, normally it's roughly in April. Of course, this year was different because we had such a moderate winter. We had it actually in March, early March, and we harvested almost a month early as well, our normal harvest. Oh, it's late August, early September. It just kind of depends. This year it was more early August. It was, you know, we needed to really get them off or they were going to be gone in a hurry. So it was one of those things where it was an odd year overall, but our normal times are April to early September. As far as the highs, I mean, you know, during the summer, especially in August, it can get up to, you know, 90 usually. With 95 and 100 not being all that uncommon at all. During the winter, our lowest of lows is probably around zero, five above, somewhere in there. Below zero is pretty rare. But we have to have, obviously, some pretty hardy rootstock to handle that weather. So we have some, you know, a lot of the vines just in general grown in Missouri. They're similar vines that are grown in places like Virginia and the mountainous part of Virginia, the eastern part of New York, Michigan, those kind of places where you have to have stuff that can handle, you know, both the heat and also the cooler weather in the winter, and in some cases, you know, pretty heavy freezes. So,
do you have to stack up a bunch of leaves or grass or dirt around the base of the plants, or are they pretty well cold hardy? You don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, they're pretty cold hardy. We don't really have now. We are doing, like, right now in front of our buildings, we have some vineyard out there. We're doing some test grows, you know, just planting some new vines, some new variants, just to see how they do over the course of a winter. But the ones that we grow, we generally know they do well without, you know, a whole lot of maintenance over the winter months.
Oh, very good. What bricks do you usually get for a harvest? Where are you usually setting on the bricks?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Where are you usually setting on bricks on harvest? Sugar levels, are they?
You know, I honestly don't know that part, only because I'm the business manager. My father-in-law, who actually he purchased the property originally, he is the one that does a lot of the vintner work. And while I do know some of the generalities of it, the technicals, I don't actually reach that point. So I apologize for that.
Well, that's fine. I didn't want to put you on the spot. I told you I wouldn't put you on the
right
spot, and I did. You know, a lot, you're very knowledgeable, and I thought maybe you might know that. You know, that,
I'm one of those guys that knows enough to be deadly. Put it that way.
Nice. well, you know, we talked to Warren. I got a blank on this now.
Danny or Bobby?
No, another vineyard. I can't. I've got a blank right now. Mike, can you help me out on this? Well, who did we talk to a couple weeks ago? And I can't. My notes are all scrambled here, and I can't find him. Vernon at Wineflower.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Yeah, we talked to Vernon back about close to a month ago now, and he was saying that he was harvesting at about 20-22 bricks, which it seemed very high to me, and I just wondered if that was just standard around there or not. And so, I wasn't trying to put you on the spot. I thought maybe you knew that. But
that's all right. If you need that info, I can get that to you.
Yeah, I was just curious if that's standard or not. How many acres of each of the grapes do you have planted out there?
We don't have a lot. Our total number of rough vineyards is about 4 acres, so it's not a lot. It's enough to produce about 25% of our total bottling. So, and then we, like I said, we go to some other local, there's some There's several local vineyards in the Kansas City area. I'd say, well, you know, an hour out within a hour radius outside of Kansas City where we can purchase grapes. So
really, there's that many growers around.
There are. Well, I mean, there's, you know, such an increased need. I mean, you know, I'd say 5 years ago there was only one or two really vineyards in the, especially in the north part of Kansas City where more of the vineyards are, and you know now we have eight to ten in the north part of Kansas City alone.
Wow.
So you know those, a lot of those are fresh and brand new. Some of them have good vineyards, some of them don't, and so there's an obvious demand right away to say, hey, I should just go out and grow some grapes for these guys, and they have the demand set up to meet those supplies. So.
Oh, that's amazing. I never realized there was that many. Like I said, I grew up and I never realized. I was just up there when I was visiting you, and I had no idea there was that many vineyards around.
Yeah,
in the
I'd say on the Missouri side of Kansas City, I believe there's around 11, and even on the Kansas side, I think there's three or four over there on that side as well. And there's some good name ones, like Holy Fields on the Kansas City side is another one that's doing very well.
Huh. Oh, well, that's interesting. What wines do you make? Let's talk about your wines.
Okay, we make three whites and three reds. We do a dry, a semi-dry, and a sweet on both sides. You know, it just provides a good, strong base of wines, you know, or no matter whether you're someone who prefers something more dry or, you know, some of the newer drinkers who obviously prefer the sweeter wines usually. We have kind of a range there. The whites that we have, our dry white is a Chardonnay, which is a hybrid grape that crossed Chardonnay with Sauvignon to create that grape. It's a pretty popular grape to use in the Missouri area just because it grows pretty well. And then our other two white wines are blends. Our semi-dry has Traminette, Vignol, and then it has about 7% of California Sauvignon. They pick out just a flavor profile out of there, but it's still the Missouri rule is 75% of the grapes have to come from Missouri to be considered Missouri wine. So in that one's case, it's 93%.
Uh-huh.
And then our sweet one is called Sorelli Dolci. It is a blend of Symphony and Cayuga. And it's a dessert wine. It's going to be, you know, similar. People who like a sweet Moscato or something along those lines, it's going to be similar to that.
The Symphony and Cayuga, do you grow those around there, or you get that from New York?
Those are both grown in-state, yeah. Now,
are they?
You're correct. They are grown heavily in New York as well. But, yeah, that's at 100% Missouri grape wine. So
wow.
They are both grown locally.
Wow. I didn't realize they were able to grow those, especially the guy over in Missouri. Right?
Yeah, we like, you know, there's a lot of grapes that are pulled in from other regions that grow pretty well because we have such a broad, you know, weather spectrum as far as Missouri goes. It gets so hot and it gets cool that there's a lot of things that can fall within that. And then our red side, our dry is a Norton. Norton's the state grape of Missouri. It's just a good, hearty red grape. They grow it a lot in the mountains of Virginia as well. And then down in Arkansas, they usually call it Cynthiana is what they usually use it for. So it's one of those deals, just depending on where you live, it's called something. But it's a good grape, and it's actually a growing wine as far as popularity. It's a fickle grape to work with, but you know it's one of those deals that if it's done right, it can be a really quality dry wine. The other two that we have, the semi-dry and the sweets, are also blends as well. Casanova is our semi-dry, and it's made with. Oh boy, I'm blanking out. It does have 7% California Syrah. It's similar.
Chamberson.
Yeah, and then Chamberson, yes. And
St. Vincent.
Thank you.
I'm reading your website.
that's right. I don't have it right in front of me, and I say it every day, and then, of course, I forget when I'm talking about it eventually. But Casanova is actually named after the family dog. And
oh!
it was not used in the making of the wine, but... that it was named there. It's a good, very, very good dog and a very good wine. It's a smooth red wine. I'd say it's more of a, you know, a table type wine. It's something that's easy to drink. It's not too sweet, not too dry. And then our sweet wine that we have is called Lucky Pierre, and it's made with Concord and Chamberson. It's about 50-50. If it's not exact 50-50, it's just a couple percent either way. But it's just a good, you know, it's got a Concord base, so obviously the Concord is the main flavor in it, even though it's kind of an even split. And then the Chamberson gives a little tart finish to it, so it's not an overly sweet dessert wine. It gives it a little bit of a different taste to it.
And the Concord is grown in Missouri there also, huh?
It is, yes.
Wow.
Yes,
wow.
It actually does very well here, so.
I'm amazed. I have to say, some of the grapes that are being grown there, I never realized. Yeah.
Yeah. Literally, the only out of all those grapes, the only two that are outside is the Saval and the Syrah, and I believe that some of the places down towards the southern end of Missouri are even trying to grow some of that Saval now as well. But the nice thing about the Chardonnay, for example, is that you get the it's a cross between two California grapes, but it's a grape that when crossed, that it actually grows pretty well here in this area, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's do you oak anything, or is everything stainless steel?
We actually oak everything. It's
do you? Wow.
Yes, it's American oak, and it varies. The sweets are around 3 months, and then it goes all the way up to the Norton. I believe it runs around 16 months.
Wow.
That's a rough guess. Don't quote me on that, but give or take a couple months. That's about the oaking time on that.
You use Missouri oak, or are you using where?
I don't believe it's Missouri oak. I can't tell you exactly, honestly, which state it's from, but it's definitely from in the Midwest.
Uh-huh. No, it could be Arkansas, it could be Kentucky or Tennessee or, Missouri. Even Texas, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania put out some nice oak.
I'd say in Missouri, generally speaking, most of them use American oak. They tend to shy away from like a French oak. American oak is just the preferred wood. People have developed a taste for that for one reason or another, and that's just the way it works.
And it's a lot cheaper.
It is. You can cut it down here.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and there's quite a few cooperages there in Missouri too. I think there's four or five of them, if I remember correctly. So yeah. So the winery itself, how long you been open? What's the background on it? How you got started on this, if you will.
Sure. Yeah, the winery itself is originally called the Oddfellows Home. The property was originally, like I said, before it was even a Springs Hotel. They actually had springs on the property where you could go in bathhouses and those kind of things. They had a pari-mutuel horse racing track on the site. They had boat rides and those kind of things. And then they had 108 rooms. They had a indoor-outdoor ballroom for 275 people. They had a six-lane bowling alley. This was in the 1880s. So it's pretty impressive. And it was kind of the trip outside Kansas City. You know, you could go a half hour outside Kansas City on the train, which is only about a mile away from the property, and you could come out, and that would be your weekend trip back then. And what happened was the hotel went bankrupt in 1895, and the Oddfellows, who are a fraternal and charitable organization similar to the Masons. They came out and purchased the property and turned it into an orphan's home and a poor home. And they had it for about 5 years, the original building, and then on Valentine's Day 1900, they went down with they wanted to desaw some pipes that were down in the basement, took a blowtorch down in the basement, and ended up burning on the entire hotel.
Wow.
Yes. So, yeah, rough Valentine's Day for sure. But they went ahead and rebuilt a new building. When they built it, they built it as the most fire-resistant structure in the United States at that time, actually. It has 18-inch brick walls. The floors are 10 inches of concrete on top of I-beams. That's why it's still in place today, obviously. It's a very sturdy building. And then they had, all the way through the 1950s, they had the orphanage and the poor home. They built three more buildings on the property. Two of them were used as old folks' homes. One was used as an old hospital building that worked for about 55 years. And then eventually the buildings kind of ran out of people inside them, and with all these buildings and a lot of maintenance and no way to, you know, pay for it. And so my father-in-law bought it off them in 1993, bought about 200 acres, including the buildings. And my late mother-in-law and his dream were to change it into a winery and a bed and breakfast. And took a while, obviously, to get the money together. It's not cheap to renovate those kind of buildings, but we were finally able to do renovation in 2009 and open up in 2011. And we've got future plans for bed and breakfast, additional event space. We already, like I said, we did, in 2011, we did 50 weddings and about 250 private events as well, in addition to being open 7 days a week, which is nice. There's a lot of tourists and those kind of things that come into the area. And right now, generally speaking, we have a lot of mom-and-pop wineries that aren't necessarily able to be open 7 days a week. And so there's a lot of people in town during the week that they don't have a good option for wineries. And there are two wineries in the Northland that are available. So we could actually get some pretty good traffic on those off days when we're one of the few options for wine for those kind of out-of-towners.
And you are part of a trail, the Great Northwest Missouri Wine Trail, is that correct?
Yes, we have 8 wineries on there. We have a Fence Still, which is located in Excelsior Springs. There's a place called Van Til. It's located in Rayville. They actually do artisan pizzas in the wood-fired oven out on the patio, which is nice. We have a new one in Osborne called Windy Wine Company. Ladoga Ridge is a one that has a lot of fun sweet wines, things like strawberry rhubarb wines, chocolate cherry. They also take their wines and they actually do slushes out of them, put them into like slush machines. So I know those have been pretty popular for them. There's Pirtle, which is in Weston. It's been a popular one for a long time. Their specialty is mead. They do honey wine. And then Shallard Creek is nearby. Riverwood is another one. I think that's all of them.
That's it. You covered them all. Very good. I got the flyer here. That's why I was following along with you. You covered
everyone. Yeah, the flyer's been very helpful because even local people, a lot of them, you know, much like you were talking about, they don't realize how many wineries have popped up in the last, 2 to 3 years. And so they see those. And it's nice because it's much like California. You know, you can do a weekend thing where you go hit 4 one day, 4 the other, or, something along those lines, and it allows them to learn a lot about the areas surrounding their own town, which a lot of people sometimes don't take the time to do that, to be honest.
And that's very true. I mean, people go away to visit things, but when they start looking at what's around them, they're amazed because they never really it so often I have people come into the winery down here and they say, I live just like 20 minutes from here, but the only reason I'm in here is because so-and-so came from this state and said, hey, do you know you have a winery close? And I get that all the time,
Yeah, so it's kind of nice for them to get that experience. And even then, we can send them out to some of the other ones that are nearby. I mean, we've got probably another 10 wineries to the south and to the east that are just as accessible.
Wow.
Which is great.
That's fantastic. It amazes me because I grew up there and I don't remember any of this. I mean, it's exploded over the last 20 years, I guess. And it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. And not only wineries are exploding, honestly, but the amount of interest in the area is exploding a lot too. I mean, you can go into your store and get wines from France, from California, from Germany, all these different areas. But, the curiosity that it builds by having some local wineries, those people learn things when they go to the local wineries, and then they go out and buy and, get interest in some of the other areas too. So it's not necessarily just this area that, helps from a, an interest standpoint as far as the wine industry in general. It helps a ton.
And you know, and that's just it. Everywhere you go, you can find wineries, and they seem to help each other promote themselves too with things like that. Are you in an AVA, American Viticulture area where you are? Or?
We are not. No, I know they're looking to form some of those type of areas in Missouri, but currently we are not.
Okay, I know Southern Missouri has one. I think the eastern part of Missouri has one too. I didn't know if you were part of it there.
We're kind of the growing end of the industry, which of course means that we're still kind of, you know, working through the process. I mean, you know, we're just now forming a trail in, you know, the second biggest metropolitan area in the state. So they had them down south where there's not that many people, and out in the middle of the state, but somehow we didn't have one. So, you know, it's we're coming along in that regard, but it's, you know, it takes a little time to put it all together.
It does. It's great, though. The government, the state government, the Missouri government, how are they toward wineries? Good, bad, indifferent? You want to hug them? You want to kill them? What's your attitude about?
I think generally it's a positive, I would say. They generally find a way to support them. There was a law that they put in the last couple of years that in order to call yourself a winery, you had to produce a certain amount. I believe it was 250 gallons of wine to call yourself a winery. Some of those, it's good or bad depending. I mean, some of the wineries, you know, they were doing nothing but purchasing, or, you know, and then having some custom crush and those kind of things.
Right.
So they had to make some changes, and there obviously are some loopholes there. But I think generally they're very supportive of some of the initiatives, and they provide new programs for things like irrigation, you know, and things like that that help with the costs involved with the vineyards.
Oh, good. Does the University of Missouri have an extension center that helps?
They do. They have actually University of Missouri is fantastic. I wouldn't call it startup, but it's still a growing program down there in Missouri where they're, you know, teaching kids to be basically vintners, you know, to come out and work at these wineries. And it's slow to develop. You know, it's one thing to do a custom crush from a big winery. It's another thing to do the production all on your own.
Right.
But I think a lot of them, you know, as some of these wineries are starting to grow, they're starting to bring some of those kids into their programs. And, you know, the University of Missouri has been very good about, you know, if you have questions about what you're doing, if you need some guidance, you know, you can call those people, you know, no charge, and they'll either talk to you on the phone, kind of help you through things, or they don't have any problem coming out and making visits. And, you know, even some of these kids that they have, you know, bringing those kids out and having them learn from what's going on actually on site versus, you know, in the classroom.
Great. That sounds like a fantastic program on that. What about a Grape Growers Association or anything like that? Is there one in Missouri?
I'm sorry, say that again one more time.
A Grape Growers Association or something like that?
There may be another in the state. At this end, currently there is not.
Oh, okay.
I think in Missouri, generally speaking, some of the wine trails, they tend to co-op, you know, kind of help each other out in that regard, but there's not a general association. There's a wine and grape growers group that mostly is marketing. We have a new passport program. I'm sure that other states have also had it as well, where basically you get a stamp every time you go to a winery, and then the more stamps you get and turn in on the official website, which is missouriwine.org, then the more rewards you get. You know, it could be anything from a neoprene sleeve or a bar towel or an apron, and then on the high end they have like a wine tasting and food pairing for 10. They have a wine dinner for 4, and then I think if you get like 90 some wineries, you get a weekend getaway for 2 to a bed and breakfast in a winery. So you know, there's a lot of incentive they're providing. We pay for it with a small tax on each bottle of wine produced / sold in the state, but it's been a very productive, and my understanding it's been a little over successful from their perspective. But you know, that's the kind of problem we want to have, obviously.
Yeah, you know, that's funny you said that. I just had a lady in the winery a couple days ago who was from Connecticut, and she said that Connecticut has a passbook or passport thing like that, and mm-hmm. you have to, out of the 32 wineries, you have to get at least 16 signed and stamped off. Then you turn it in, and it makes you eligible for different prizes, and one of the big prizes is the trip to maybe France or Germany or Italy or something like that. And that's the big prize.
Wow.
Yeah, so... But
yeah, obviously, we've got work to do in Missouri.
Yeah, I know. New Jersey does the same thing and has a big trip, too. So a few states do that, offer, you know, one big trip over overseas for signing up or for visiting so many wineries and all that. But it's a great thing, though. It really keeps people excited about the whole thing and makes them want to see wineries that way.
Yeah, so. And what they had happen, too, is they have had this program for 2 years, and now they've they're going to end it at the end of the year, but what they're doing is starting a new one in January. And I think the reason they're doing that is a lot of the winery regulars across the state for, you know, have been collecting stamps, and now they can only get one at each place. And so at this point, I think they're kind of complaining to the group, saying, listen, hey, we've already been to all these places, and we're not getting any reward for going back again. And so I think they're starting it over. I think they're going to adjust, obviously, the prizes or change them or whatever it might be, but it'll give those people the opportunity who, you know, got 100 different stamps or whatever it might be to go out and do it all over again over the next 2 years. So.
Ah, I see. Yeah, that's a lot of the states will have a time frame. You have to, the one in Connecticut, the lady was telling me that it was only like, you know, 5 months or 4 months and you had to visit them in that short period. A lot of them were only open on weekends, so it really tied up your weekend stuff. It was rather strict rules that she was talking about. So
yeah, of course you did say it was only, what did you say, it was about 32 versus, of course, Missouri's like up around 130. So
yeah,
a few more weekend trips.
Makes a big difference. It does.
Yeah.
Well, we have to talk about the paranormal activities. Before we go into that, I was looking around and reading some websites that I normally read, and one of the blogs that I read is Joy of Wine. It's a blog that I click on and read every once in a while. And she this time said, in October, when thoughts turn to harvest, Halloween, and hauntings, the perfect time to explore a haunted winery or two. So this month she went around to a couple of haunted wineries, and she found one called Dozier, and that's located in Kansas. But the second one she found, she stated, the most well-known haunted winery in the Midwest is located in the Show Me State, and it appears that they have a lot of spirits to show. Belvoir Winery in Liberty, Missouri is located on the grounds of the former IOOF, or the Independent Order of Odd Fellows District Home. And Belvoir is French for beautiful view, and that's what the owners, Dr. John and Marcia Bean, thought when they bought the property in the 1990s. Is that it is one of the largest buildings for a winery. It also is one of the most haunted. Several paranormal activities, investigative groups have been there, and they reported activities going from footsteps to screams to unidentified laughter to male spirits to shadows that move on their own to clothing being tugged. I noticed on your website that you have these paranormal activities scheduled. Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. They're actually sold out for the year. They usually sell out a month or two in advance.
Wow.
But we do the investigations usually about March of the year all the way through November while it's still warm, because we do have some activities outside involved in that process. But then we do one a month usually during most of the months, and then October you do three a month just because there's a higher demand for no other reason than Halloween, basically.
Yes.
But, our investigations that we do are a six-hour investigation, so people come out about 8 p.m. and they get to stay until around 2, roughly, in the morning. and we have a group that comes out, and I selected them, honestly. They're a much more scientific-based organization, so, I mean, they bring out their gear and set it up in the place. It's a lot of fun gear, a lot of the same kind of stuff you'll see on, you know, the shows like Ghost Hunters and that kind of stuff. And
right.
The nice thing is they set up that gear, and then, you know, the public can come out and they get to go through the process and get to investigate right along the side, the investigators in small groups, get to use all the gear that the regular investors get to use. And just kind of get a feel for, you know, what it's like. And obviously it's a lot different. A lot of people come in, you know, for their first time. We have lots of repeat visitors, but their first time, you know, they're kind of that kid at Christmas feel, you know. They come in, they're just overexcited, you know, just can't wait, you know. They want to see things fly out of the wall and everything else. And, of course, it, you know, it's one of those situations where it's not like that. I mean, you know, if you come out for an investigation, it's kind of like, say, like catfish fishing. I mean, you'll stick the cork in the water and you'll stare at the cork and nothing might happen for, you know, 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and then you'll get, boom, you know, maybe 5 seconds, 10 seconds or something. You know, that's honestly pretty incredible. And then, you know, you'll go back to staring at the cork again. I mean, that's
exactly
kind of the way these things work. It's not like on the TV shows and that kind of stuff where it's edited. So it's a great situation for them because they get to, while still it's a very exciting thing, they get to understand what the real life version of that is. And it's a whole lot of waiting and hoping at some level. I personally, I was a skeptic before I started working at the winery for my family. I'm not a skeptic anymore.
Really? You're a believer now.
I am. I've heard voices at the winery. Footsteps are pretty common. I'll sit in the bar, you know, in the morning before the place opened, and I'll hear footsteps in the hallway. I'll go out to look in the hallway, and, of course, the footsteps stop. You know, the building's locked. There's nobody there. Of course, you don't realize that at first. You have to go check all the doors and look through all the rooms and wonder, you know, where did that person just go? But, you know, at the same time, you have the realization, okay, this is not normal. I had a experience in the ballroom with my 2-year-old daughter. Her name's Giselle. We were setting up for a wedding about 7:30 in the morning, and I was looking out the front of the room and putting tablecloths on the table, and she was behind me and started walking towards the exit of the ballroom, and I said, "Giselle, come here," and she took off and ran into the hallway, and I said, "Giselle, come here," again when she was in the hallway, and I heard her say, "Mommy, Mommy," and then so I started walking towards the doorway to find out what's going on, and just as I about got to the hallway where she was, I said, "Giselle, come here," again, and she said, "Mommy, Mommy," and then I heard a female voice say, "Well, hello, little one," and then about 5 seconds after that, I came into the hallway, and Giselle was by herself in the hallway looking up, and I said, "Giselle, come here," and she turned around and smiled and came back, and you know, there was nobody in the building. So it was one of those. That was a little different. Obviously, it's one thing when you hear footsteps and it's not really interacting with you. It's another thing when you hear something talking to your daughter and it's not there. You know, so
that's fantastic. That really is.
And I know at some level it sounds crazy, and we have a surprising number of skeptics that come on our tours. You know, a lot of them come and kind of want confirmation, you know, okay, I didn't see anything. We're usually surprised at the number of skeptics that actually do experience something. We had one guy come out, and his wife was a believer, and he was a skeptic, and they were in a room together, and they actually stood on opposite ends of the room because he didn't want his wife messing around with him while they were in the room, and they asked if somebody asked, you know, if something was, you know, if something was in the room, you know, please make himself known. And we have a recording of it, and you hear a loud scream, like a girl scream, and then you hear footsteps running. And what had happened was, right after they asked for a sign, the skeptic, the man who was standing there, he felt something or someone pull on the back of his shirt, pull it down. And he was the one that screamed and ran out of the room. And he had only been there for about an hour and a half for the 6-hour investigation, but he told his wife they were leaving. He had had his experience and he was done. So
that's great. That is fantastic. So these, and let's clarify now, these people, all this now, they attribute that to the people back when the hospital was there and when they used to, the old folks home was there, and the people have died there, because there is a big graveyard on the site there, I understand, also.
There is. The Oddfellow Cemetery is on the back part of the property. Honestly, the graveyard part of the property is one of the quietest parts of the property. The cemetery was made, basically, if you're an Oddfellow or a Rebecca, which is the sister organization of the Oddfellows, you could be buried there. Or if you were like an orphan or an old folk who passed away on the property and either weren't claimed by your family or couldn't afford a proper burial, then you could be buried in that area as well. But not only that, I mean, the hospital that was on site, it was a medical hospital for, you know, over 50 years. And then, of course, the old folks' home, you know, I mean, even in like the 30s, they had people that died simply because their room was too hot. And I think between the old folks' home and the hospital, there's over 10,000 recorded deaths on the property. So I mean,
10,000? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, so it's not, you know, I mean, they honestly, you know, in the 30s, 40s, those kind of, they didn't have a lot of the cures that we have. You know, people could die of, you know, something as simple as an infection or something like that. And, you know, so people just died a lot more back there. It wasn't always go in and get cured, leave the hospital. It's not always the way it worked. So.
Yeah, I never realized that many there. I knew people had died up at that location, but I never realized it was that many. It's a beautiful location, by the way, too. I mean, it just always has been. I remember for all my life driving by it and understanding that it was the Oddfellows home down there, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful building.
Yeah, it is. It's fantastic. It's very unique. And we restored it, you know, to where the wood floors are still, the original wood floors are still in there from over 100 years ago. The tile floor is still original. The you know, wood doors, the wood frames, the window sills, they all had some really bad colored paint on them when we started restoring. And so what we did was we took apart the windows, numbered them. There were 76 windows, and as you know, you've been there. I mean, each of the windows is about at least 7 foot tall.
Right.
So there's a lot of board foot going on in there. So we sanded it down and planed it, and then restored it and stained it. So it was a lot of hard work, you know. But I think in the end, you know, people talk about how nice it looks and how original it looks. You know, it doesn't look like it's been restored to a modern building necessarily. It looks like you're walking into, you know, something that's in the past. So
yeah. And it is great. It does look like, I mean, it looks just like when I, like I said, I used to drive by it for years and years growing up in my family, and it looks just like as always. You did an excellent job of keeping it, the integrity of the original building, because it is gorgeous and it hasn't changed any. I love it, what you've done to it, too. So.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of the items, you know, old ritual items from the Oddfellows. We have a lot of that stuff there. We have old toys that were found in the walls of the building, you know, when we renovated and gutted the walls. We found a lot of things that the orphans had, you know, obviously stuck in holes in the wall at some point, and they just ended up being encased in the wall for, you know, 70 years, and nobody knew they were there. And, you know, we pull out a wall, and out would pop, you know, tinker toys, marbles, rubber balls, stuff that's mundane and you know, it's not of any value really, but you know, when you see it within the concept of, you know, what the building is, you know, it's fantastic that all that kind of stuff we found after all those years, and you realize where it's been, and it's really cool.
Yeah, it is. Without question, it is really cool. Mike, do you have any questions or anything for Jesse?
I'm just looking at the photo gallery. When we give the website information, everybody check out the website. The photos of this is incredible. The property itself, the buildings and everything, it's just amazing.
It's beautiful.
And a great history. I mean, I was going through the history. Oh, wow, I love that stuff. So, yeah, very nice. We'll give that information out to everybody so they can check it out and go from there. As far as the paranormal goes, I know you have a lot of tours scheduled, and, of course, they're all sold out, so you don't need – you know, TV time for advertising on that, but have you ever contacted, you know, the groups that are on TV and said, hey, come out and, you know, check out our building sometime, or have you gotten to that point yet?
You know, we have had interest expressed in the past. Some of those shows, it's kind of a mixed bag, honestly. Yeah, I mean, it's really neat to get that added attention, but that attention sometimes can cause problems. I mean, if they...
Right.
Come out and you know, maybe people watch the show, and obviously once you come, they come out, you know, you can't really control what they show. I mean, and some of them can get pretty excited about, you know, something as simple as a door squeaking, you know, which honestly, I mean,
right.
If people see that and they feel like they're, creating too much hubbub over nothing or something like that, it can really hurt,
oh.
for lack of a better way of saying it, the credibility of the site as a haunted location. So it's one of those deals where it's, yeah, it would be neat, but I don't know if I want to go there. I mean, we
right.
are known in, you know, a good portion of the Midwest as a haunted location, and
yeah.
I think word of mouth works almost as well as those shows, to be honest.
Yeah, I was thinking you don't need it, and plus the events as it looks like anyway. I mean, they're sold out. So
yeah, we have people call every day and say sorry, you know, check the Facebook site next January, and we'll put out the new schedule and book quicker this time.
That's amazing. And it looks like you keep busy with other events as well. You have weddings, and what else you have on your baby shower? Just this month, I mean, it's pretty busy.
Yep.
I have a great venue there for that. So, yeah, definitely when we give out the website address and everything, people listening out there, you want to check it out. It's a great site, great photos, and the history is amazing. So, yeah, check it out, definitely. So that's all I had. Just
all right. Thank you, Mike.
Cool comment there. Thank you.
Yeah. Like Mike just said there, all the contact information for you, your phone number, your address, your Facebook page, your number, address, Facebook page.
That's right.
Everything except
my personal phone number.
Yeah, well, I won't give that out. I'll keep that myself. But
yeah,
and
it's
also,
called
before I forget,
Belvoir Winery. Yeah, Belvoir Winery is the name of the winery. It's spelled BELVOIR Winery. The website is belvoirwinery.com. Our phone number, in case you want to call us directly, is 816-200-1811. And Facebook is just Belvoir Winery. I mean, there's no other Belvoir Wineries on Facebook, so you're safe in just typing that into the search. And then as far as hours, we're open 7 days a week, Monday through Wednesday is 11 to 4, Thursday through Saturday is 11 to 8, and Sunday is 12 to 6. We'd love to have people come by and stop in while they're in town. There's a lot of barbecue and wine to be had in Kansas City. So,
and they have a ice cream parlor there on it. So, you know, you bring the kids, and if you don't drink wine, you can still go and look at all the building and everything, and have yourself some ice cream. You don't have to drink wine to visit them. So, that's
always
cool too.
Yeah, I'd say
we have
probably about 15% of our people that come in. They do nothing more than just look around the building. They don't buy anything from us, and that's okay. We understand, you know, that while we're running a business, certainly it's a historic site, and you know, people just love learning more about history, and that's quite all right. We know they'll tell it to somebody else who likes wine, and they'll come out eventually. So,
The building, okay. You know, when you walk in the front door, and whenever you all look at the website here, you'll see pictures. When you walk in the front door, you go straight back, and the little tasting room is right straight back. But you have this enormous building around you. Is it being utilized for anything?
The second story and the third story are both currently gutted. We already have plans drawn for this. The second story, we're going to put in probably two additional ballrooms, much larger ones, say 250, 300 person. And then third floor, we're going to put in it'll either be a 9 or a 10 room bed and breakfast. There'll be one 1,600-foot bridal suite, and then the other rooms will be 800 square feet. So they'll be pretty large rooms. But, I mean, you know, with each floor being, you know, 12,000 square foot at a minimum, I mean, there's plenty of room for all those rooms to
yeah.
fit in there. So,
without a doubt.
Exactly.
You know, it's a gorgeous building. Well, Jesse, thank you so – oh, and before I forget to tell Rachel that she missed out. She could have done this too.
Yes, Rachel does a fine job at organizing our events. So all the events you see on the calendar are all due to her. So we'll give her some credit.
Okay, she was a little nervous, leery that you might not be able to do it, and she would have to. So, so thank you very much for your time tonight. Really appreciate it. It was a great program, and anyone out there who likes to know some more information, by all means, get in touch with him. I'm sure Jesse will be more than happy to explain to you more, talk to you more about Belvoir Winery in Liberty, Missouri. And thanks a lot for joining us tonight. It was a great program.
All right, sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye. Bye now.
Well, there we go.
That was fun.
Very cool.
Yeah. That was... I think that's the first wine we talked to that really had ghost.
Yes. Sounds like it.
Yeah, that was fun.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And great history. I just reading through their stories, like, oh my gosh, and it's huge.
It's a beautiful place. It's absolutely beautiful. And I said it while I was talking to Jesse, and it's true. When I was growing up, I used to Liberty, Missouri is only like 20 minutes from where I grew up. It's just north of us. In fact, I dated a girl right after I got out of high school that lived there in Liberty. So it's, you know, it was like I spent a lot of time in Liberty. And the Oddfellows home has been there forever. After it burned down in the early 1900s, they rebuilt it. And it's been there forever, and everybody knew about the Oddfellows home. We drove by, and everybody knew what it was. And they, you know, and then the time I moved away from the place, it was still being used as a retirement home, and there was still some of the hospital there and stuff like that. And so I just got updates periodically through my adult life what was happening with it. And it fell into major disrepair for a while there. But it was great that they ended up buying it and fixing the thing up.
What kind of population is Liberty? Is it a big town? Is it a small town? Or
not really. Let's see. Liberty is, the population, I don't know. I hate to guess what the population is because I would probably be wrong, either high or low. Liberty's an old town. It's got a town square. The town itself, Liberty is an old town. It was the first daylight bank robbery ever in the United States, and it was committed by Jesse James right there. And so they got a little museum on the town square and talk about it. Liberty also is it's a Mormon jail there. Martin Luther, when he was going through Smith. William Smith or something. I think it might be William Smith who led the people out west to find the land where they finally ended up in Utah for the Mormon Church. Well, he was arrested in Missouri and thrown in jail there.
Joseph Smith.
Joseph, thank you, Joseph Smith. And he was thrown in jail in Missouri for a while there, and that's you can tour the old jail. They've got it, they got a building around it, but you can tour the jail and all that, and see the jail and all. So that's right there, just a couple blocks off the square. But it's just an old Missouri town there that's been there for a long, long time, and Kansas City was far enough away from it that it didn't interfere with it. And Jesse said it was, the suburbs, but not really. I mean, when I look at suburbs, I look at towns that are being, right on top of another town. And Liberty's, a little bit north of it. Liberty's also the home of Hallmark Cards Warehouse. Everybody is familiar with Hallmark Cards and the big warehouse, this enormous building. On the outskirts of Liberty the thing actually is so long it has a slight curvature because of the curvature of the earth. I mean, this thing is a big, big, long warehouse, and they have all the stuff for Hallmark there and everything. So it's just but not a big town, not a real, real big town, but it's like I'd say 80% of the cities and towns in this country, a little town that sits just northeast of Kansas City there.
I found when I was looking up the Joseph Smith, it was on one of the sites, and it has the population in 2011 is 29,557.
Oh,
so
okay.
And it goes through all kinds of history down there. That's or up there. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's got quite a bit of history in that little town there. I mean, Jesse James is right around there. A lot of stuff that happened. The folk hero who was really a bank robber, but But they're exploding with wineries all around the place there and everything too. It's just in the growing. It, you know, from what Jesse said, there's so many growers around there. That amazes me. That just absolutely mm-hmm. amazes me. All the growers they have there. So, but yeah. interesting, yeah. interesting, interesting interview tonight. That was fun with him and
definitely.
Something I want to cover, though, before we get off the air tonight, something that was in the paper today, and y'all might have seen it on the news out there, but the European grape harvest, it's been on, well, TV, the evening news has been picking up all the major channels and everything, and most of the papers on the country. But if you haven't noticed it, haven't heard about it, haven't seen anything, European grape harvest this year is really, really down, a major decline. And the reason is because of weather. Drought throughout the year, hailstorms right before harvest, and hailstorms hit a lot of the areas, not just France, but France, Italy, Germany, Spain. A lot of these areas are down on their production this year. It's the Champagne region. The grape harvest there could decline by as much as 40% this year, which is substantial. The Beaujolais region expected a decline of 30%. The Bordeaux region, 10%. Now, this is over last year, and last year was low compared to the average. Italy is going through the same thing. Italy's harvest is down. Spain is down a little bit. Germany is down. The weather that hit the European area of the world through this summer and into the fall, right before harvest, really has caused a major reduction in the number of plants. It is hurt. And, you know, you think, well, yeah, okay, but consider the fact that about 2.5 million families live off the wine sector. So this could affect up to 2.5 million people who depend on the grape growing industry and the wine and all that in Europe. And they, you know, they all depend on the weather, how the weather is going to treat it and all that. And the weather this year has been bad. So, you know, if you haven't noticed that drought in the Mediterranean rim, has caused problems, a dry spell throughout the summer, very dry. In the south, it was hitting almost 0 degrees Celsius, 32 degrees and freezing. Northern regions was cold and wet, was wreaking havoc on the grapes. And, you know, just all sorts of stuff. So they said you won't see an effect in the stores now on prices, because there's enough different vintages out there, and you can see enough different years and stuff. But the 2012 vintage, it's going to be some good wine, because the grapes that did survive and the grapes that they did make wines from are going to be very good, but it's also going to be expensive. So the 2012 vintage coming out of France and Italy and Germany and Spain, it could be a very good vintage, but it's very small vintage compared to the average. So I wanted to cover that tonight a little bit there.
Yeah, very cool. Very good. Let's see. You also have a special, we'll call it a wine fest, sort of?
Yeah. Yes, we do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. I noticed on the newsletter, it's an SPCA fundraiser, and it's going to a good cause, this the tip jar you're going to have especially for the SPCA for the event, and that is this Saturday, October the 20th, which is 14 divided by 2, day after tomorrow. So throw that in there. 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. And, come out to Florida State's Winery, the SPCA of Hernando County. We'll have pets, prizes, drawings, and a lot of fun this Saturday at Florida State's Winery. And the tip jar for this month is for Toys for Tots, but again, for the event, it'll be designated to the SPCA. So definitely come out and help out and support the SPCA this Saturday at Florida State's Winery. That's October the 20th, this Saturday, day after tomorrow, 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. There's going to be wine tasting. Let's see, if you have it's a $15 donation for, you get a wine tasting, souvenir glass, cheese and cracker snacks, surprise raffle ticket, vendors to shop, pets to adopt, live music, and a lot of fun. And there's going to be a lot of vendors. The weather's going to be fantastic. So definitely come out this Saturday, 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., Florida State's Winery again, and support a great cause, the SPCA of Hernando County and the SPCA. So check it out. It's a fundraiser special there at the winery, and it's going to be great. There's going to be vendors, and it's going to be a wine fest. So very, very cool, and enjoy it there. So then Sunday, wow, Sunday you have a wine class.
Right, yeah.
And the next day, wow, that's okay. October 21st from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. And you can join Florida State's Winery winemaker, vineyardist, cellar master, and tasting expert Ron as he shares his. Who is Ron? Oh, that's right.
He's around. So,
as he shares his experience and educational knowledge of wine in a detailed wine class. It's a lot of fun, and you're a great presenter and everything. I love the wine tasting and everything that you do, and it's a fantastic presentation and everything. You cover the brief history of wines, the wine grape varietals, diseases, glass styles and uses, cork history, evolution and uses, oak aging, wine tasting and rating wines, and a sampling of wines and a discussion. And that is also at the Florida State's Winery in the tasting room. So you definitely want to check that out. And for more information, you can contact the winery either by email or a phone call and get in touch with them, or just come on out, located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. And phone number is 813-996-2113. And I'll give all the particulars during our exit audio. There you go.
Yes.
the show ending thing. So
the closing.
That'll be cool. The closing stuff. So definitely check it out, and give them a call if you have any questions or anything. Next week is going to be the 25th.
I think we might be talking to the winery in Iowa.
In Iowa. Okay. Well, that's cool. So
call them. Be sure that they're able to get on the air, and we'll be talking to a winery in Iowa.
Very good. I checked that earlier, but I don't remember if that was.
I can't find it right now, but winery in Iowa.
Okay.
So,
Definitely. If you know want to, please like us on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, go to facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. That's the best place to get up to date information on the shows. And 21 hours ago, you announced that Jesse from the winery in Liberty is going to be. So that's the best way. Plus, you put all other information about shows and stuff on the page there. So definitely follow the show on there. And on Twitter, it's twitter.com, the same thing, /allaboutwinebtr. And I did a couple of tweets while he was talking, so I might have missed some of that, the chat. But I got quite a bit out of that. That's very interesting first night. So. And you mentioned Holyfield, and we talked to Holyfield.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, we talked to Holyfield, and I pulled up the notes on Vernon Reed from Wine Flower. Mm-hmm. So I finally found that, and very very cool. That, that's two more great wineries there that we talked to not too long ago. So
which was fun.
Very good.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah,
some good conversation in there.
Yep. Definitely. So we will see everybody next Thursday, October 25th, and we should have a guest from Iowa on the program. Join us then at 7 p.m. Eastern Time right here on Blog Talk Radio. And I guess we're done.
I guess we're done.
All right. Thanks a lot for listening. And
thank
we'll see
you, everyone.
Next time.
See you next time.
Oh, here we go. Yeah. Ready? One,
everyone
two,
dance.
Three. Yeah.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio. A special thanks to our special guests who have appeared on the show, and thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in and supporting All About Wine. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and like our Facebook page. Go to twitter.com or facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. We welcome your comments and questions by email at allaboutwine101@gmail.com. The email address again is allaboutwine101@gmail.com. All About Wine is a weekly program featuring Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida Estates Winery. The winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. From Interstate 75, take exit 285 and go west for approximately 4 miles. Or from US 19, the Suncoast Parkway, and US 41, go east on State Road 52. The winery is open daily, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. for retail sales and wine tasting. Visit the gift shop and enjoy the peaceful setting outside under a large shady canopy of oak trees. Florida Estates Winery is pet friendly and picnics are welcome. For more information, call area code 813-996-2113. That's area code 813-996-2113. Or visit us on the web at www.floridaestateswines.com. Again, that's floridaestateswines.com. Be sure to subscribe to our informative bi-weekly newsletter. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio.